free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen, and our guest today is Trey Taylor from Verdant Power. They have a tidal energy system, river energy system, that has been prototype and testing situation for quite some time. They've been on several television shows. CNN, I believe, did a special on them at one point. Trey, thank you for the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here with you, Sterling.
Yeah, you've got a tidal. Would that be the most appropriate way to describe it, or is it just any moving water system or a system that can change direction, such as a tidal situation? How would you qualify it? Is it just tidal or also river power?
Oh, it's tidal and river and then some. I'll explain. What we're doing is converting the kinetic energy of moving water, in other words, water currents or streams, that can be found in ocean currents, tidal currents, river currents, and even in constructed waterways such as man-made irrigation canals and aqueducts.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of... in terms of depth or speed, are there any limitations there?
There are. We have two types of basic systems. The one that's in the New York City right now in the East River, which is a tidal strait, we call those, sort of a euphemism, we call those free-flow turbines. In other words, these systems look a lot like wind turbines, but completely submerged underwater, using the tidal flow of the strong current in the East River, and it's designed to work in both directions. So as it flows, it turns this rotor underwater very slowly, by the way. It's only about 32 revolutions per minute. And then that mechanical power is then converted to electrical power and then brought ashore. And one of the historic firsts that we're doing in New York is actually not only generating this power, but delivering it to customers in New York City.
So presently there are light bulbs in New York City being lit by your energy system.
Ah, more than light bulbs. The two current customers, one's a large supermarket, and so not only light bulbs, but we're keeping the lettuce fresh and we're keeping ice cream from melting. And the other customer is a large parking garage. And interestingly, in that parking garage are state-owned electric vehicles, battery-powered vehicles, that is. And so these electric vehicles are being recharged by our tidal power, which I think is another interesting story.
Well, it is, because that makes a hybrid electric or a plug-in type of electric vehicle completely renewable, so it's not getting electricity from fossil fuel, but from renewable fuel, in this case, river energy. That's great.
That's right. That's right. And these are all electric vehicles that are plugging into this tidal power.
All electric. They're not hybrids.
That's right. That's correct.
Great. Now, tell us... is the reason for the low RPM, is that to avoid fish kill or what?
No, it's actually, there's a correlation between the rotor speed and the generator speed. So everything we design is with these two basic functions in mind, or two basic functions of physics that are in mind, and that is the sweep of the rotor and the speed of the current. And quite simply, what that means is the stronger the current, the larger the generator we can put in there. And it's a matter of maxing the kind of the revolutionary speeds with the power of the generator to create electricity. So no matter how large a rotor might become, it'll always continue to rotate about that speed of 32 to 35 revolutions per minute.
Now, help us lay people out for a second here, because it seems an obvious fit of electricity to a flowing river. Why hasn't this been done before? And you're talking about some firsts here with your company and some bests with your company. Why is it taking so long, and what are the costs and other practical considerations, hurdles that you've had to surmount to get to the point that you're at now?
Well, there's a lot of factors that are coming to bear. Certainly, there's the concern about global warming, growing supply of electricity, the diminishing quantity of fossil fuels such as natural gas, oil, and coal, which are the primary fuel sources that are used to create electricity. But interestingly, the idea of tidal power or using moving water has been around for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. In fact, the Romans had a tidal power system in London back in 787 AD, but they used that power as a grist mill. So what's changed since that time are these two basic ideas. One is the advancement in design knowledge and material usages, and also the computer. We're able to do 3D CAD/CAM drawings and illustrations and literally put designs into virtual waterways to see how they might work and operate before we actually build a prototype. And to date, we've built four different working prototypes for four different types of water conditions.
Mm-hmm. And those prototypes are built after your 3D modeling?
Well, that's part of it. And that's all part of a contribution to it. The concepts have been around for a long time. The other thing that's beginning to drive this business, and the economics of it certainly, is generally speaking, we're moving away from centralized power to decentralized power. And by that I mean smaller, environmentally benign plants that are closer to end users. And by that, what we're doing is bypassing the transmission lines that usually bring electricity from big central power plants to a local community, and then the power is what we call stepped down into the local distribution grid. But if you think for a moment, through every major city or every kind of urban context, there's some form of flowing water, whether it's a tidal strait like that that's in New York City, or a river, or it could be a constructed waterway such as a large irrigation canal or aqueduct. And so everything we're designing are to be closer to where the power is needed, and that's in those kinds of situations.
What about, I mean, this may be a bit gross, but what about even a sewage system? Could you, are you going to not want to impede the flow? Or if you've got a city that's got a good drainage away from the city and you've got sewage, could you conceivably even use that power?
Yes, you're absolutely right. It gets very interesting when you begin to look at the applications of these technologies. Oh, and by the way, we call them kinetic hydropower systems or free flow systems, or in some cases accelerated flow systems. But it's the whole idea of not damming water at all, but what we're doing is just channeling the energies in that moving current. Anyway, to answer your question, conceivably, yes. And so we are even looking at systems that can go into, to your very good point, water treatment facilities that have lots of moving water going through them, and we're designing systems that can actually snap into place without interfering with the water conveyance within those systems, but at the same time produce electricity not only for the power plant, but so much that that little power plant could be turned into a distributed generation power plant for the community.
What are your ranges of sizes at present?
Well, right now we have built a 3-meter rotor, which is about a 10-meter diameter rotor, and the systems that are now in the East River actually operating and generating power, those are 5-meter diameter rotors, about 16 feet in size, completely submerged. So during mean low-low tide, that tip of the rotor to the surface of the water has about 6 to 8 foot of clearance. We're also looking now at yet one more up next grade to about a 7-meter diameter rotor that could go into larger rivers like the St. Lawrence River or eventually into the Amazon Basin and for the Amazon River and some of its tributaries. But ultimately, we could even be in an 11-meter rotor at that large that could go into really deep, fast waters such as the Bay of Fundy or in Puget Sound. And that gets interesting in, because the waters are deeper and faster than the waters of the East River of New York. Those turbines might have a 1-megawatt generator in each of them rather than a 35-kilowatt generator that's in the generators in New York City.
Mm-hmm. Are those actually on the drawing board, or is that still just kind of pencil and paper on a business plan?
No, beyond that, the success we're having in New York, what we're doing next is optimizing that system, which means we're scaling it for manufacturing. In the process of doing that, we're also looking at how these now can be scaled up in size to for the deeper, faster waters, such as those that I just mentioned. Coupled up with that, though, we're also teaming up with an international marine engineering firm that's called Oceaneering International. This is a company that's designed and built many of the offshore oil floating platforms. But we're designing new systems to make it really easy to use local resources for installing the systems and retrieving them for operation and maintenance. All of that will lower the costs significantly once we get them commercialized or into mass production. So it's a long-winded answer to your question, but absolutely we're looking at systems that could work in larger, deeper waters, real easy to scale up now that we have them operating in the sizes that I've just mentioned to you.
Now, in this New York installation where you're, as we speak, generating electricity for two New York customers, a grocery store and a parking garage, what kind of price point are you at? Are you competitive with what they were getting from the grid, or where are you at?
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, we're expensive. That's because we're still very much in a startup stage, but I guess maybe beyond startups, more pre-commercial. And the reason we're expensive at the moment is that these are all one-offs. In other words, we're building them by hand. They haven't been optimized yet, nor are we in commercialization. Costs right now are probably about $4,800 to $5,000 per kilowatt installed. However, our path to commercialization is so clean right now. It's very clear where we're going in lowering the costs in three primary areas, so that we see when we reach commercialization, the cost will be at about $2,400 per kilowatt installed, and that's for a water-to-wire turnkey system.
Just for the listeners' point of reference, I understand a diesel generator is about $1 per watt or $1,000 per kilowatt installed, but that doesn't take into consideration the cost of the diesel to keep it running.
There you go. Right. Oh, and also let me add one more thought to that as well. It's really easy to try to it's the temptation to try to compare those of us in renewable energy and our costs to, let's say, diesel fuel or to coal or to natural gas fire plants. Mm-hmm. But what it doesn't take into account are what we call the externality costs. What are the costs that those plants and their greenhouse gas emissions are doing to the environment in terms of pollution, environmental cleanup, of health, of hospital care? So those costs, in fact, there's a lot of economists now who are beginning to work those costs in to show even unsubsidized renewable energies are already cost competitive with the fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and one more thing I should add to all of that. It's only a matter of time before we begin to see carbon taxes put on the fossil fuels. In fact, the province of Quebec in Canada has already added a penny and a half carbon tax on gasoline. Eventually, there's going to be a global carbon tax if we're to really go after the culprit of global warming, which, quite frankly, is the burning of coal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that those carbon taxes are starting to make it into law in as you mentioned, in Canada and other places. California will probably be one of the first in the states to do it. They seem to be quite ahead of the curve when it comes to clean energy. Where are you going next? You're in New York now. When are we going to start seeing these things available for commercial installation?
Well, the next step in California, here's how the process works in the United States. The regulatory process is such that in order to generate electricity out of any navigable waters, it requires a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission license. Now, that commission, which we call FERC, F-E-R-C, usually will allow a company to obtain a preliminary permit, which then puts the onus on the company to study a particular site for up to 3 years to try to get a handle on the environmental impacts. Once those studies are complete, then a company such as ours will file for a license for which an application that is for a license. Once we have a license in hand, then we begin to build out in incremental stages a full field of turbines. So in New York, for example, the ultimate field, once we have a FERC license, could be as many as 300 turbines. The installed capacity could be as much as 10 megawatts of electricity. And that's just one location. Now, there'll be multiple locations around New York City and in Long Island Sound, which could be part of the renewable energy mix. So our next step is to commercially build out the field of tidal turbines in New York. We've also opened up offices in Canada, and we're looking at creating river turbines in the St. Lawrence River for many of the communities in Ontario, on the Ontario side of St. Lawrence River, and upstate New York on the New York side. The beauty of river power, unlike tidal power, is that in utility speak, the capacity factor is much larger. And I can explain that if you'd like me to continue.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. What that means is, and let me use wind as an example. On land, the average capacity factor for wind turbines ranges between 27 and probably about 32%. What that means is, let's say a wind farm has 10 megawatts of installed capacity. That means you count the number of wind turbines. Let's say, for example, there are 10 wind turbines, and each turbine has a megawatt generator inside. So that means it has a 10 megawatt installed capacity. However, wind is pretty episodic. I mean, the wind industry is pretty good at getting a handle on when the wind might blow. Still, it's episodic. You can't really count on it. But it averages out over the course of the year that it might blow, maybe, let's say, 30% of the time. And so that's called a capacity factor. The factor of the amount of power that produces is about 30%. And that's pretty much average for wind on land. It's a little bit larger offshore. I think it gets closer to maybe 40% offshore, which is really great for wind. And so tidal turbines, for example, in the East River, we've already measured this, have about a 30% capacity factor. In other words, the same capacity factor as wind. The difference, though, is tidal power is very reliable and predictable. You can look at a tidal chart and your clock, and you know exactly when the power is coming on and when it's going off. And so that's the advantage of tidal power and its capacity factor of 30%. In rivers, however, big rivers such as the St. Lawrence River, the Columbia River up in Oregon and Washington, some of the bigger rivers in California, and even to some extent, like in Northern California, the Klamath River, and to some extent the Sacramento River, American River, all these rivers are pretty predictable in how long they flow. Therefore, the capacity factor could be twice as much, maybe as much as 60%, or in some cases, 80%. And that could be 24-hour renewable energy, which gets pretty interesting when you look at its contribution to the mix. So our next step is...
I'm scratching my head for a second on this one, because why wouldn't a large river be 100%? It flows all the time.
Well, it's interesting. The challenge to us, well, first of all, you're going to have some downtime for repair and maintenance or upgrades. Mm-hmm. So the whole field wouldn't be operating to full capacity 100%. But you could design a field so that anytime any section is down for repair, maintenance, and upgrades, it's still generating the amount of power. The other factor to consider is the flow. There's the seasonalities of the flow.
Okay.
During certain seasons, there's a constant flow. But let's say during really low seasons or non-rainy seasons, the velocity of the water may slow up. So we're guessing we could probably never quite get 100%. But the challenge to our engineers is to see if we couldn't indeed get 100% out of some, especially these bigger, deeper rivers.
In an interview we had with another tidal person, Martin Berger up in Blue Energy Systems, he was saying that if you had it wouldn't take much to install a number of tidal turbines up a coast, and while one might be down, the other one would be coming online because just the nature of the periodicity, you don't have to be that far removed to make sure that at any given time for one grid system, at least one turbine is generating power. So you actually could have a primary power scenario with tide.
Yeah, he makes a good point. I mean, yes, theoretically that could work. And also the beauty of these types of systems, that he's talking about and what we have in New York, for example, they're all modular systems, meaning you could scale up an individual size for each turbine, but also you can scale by how many turbines you put into an underwater field. And so he's absolutely right. You could design fields and array configurations in such a way that theoretically you could have 24-hour tidal power. And on certain island situations, you could have tidal turbines on one side of the island and then have them on the other side. So as the tides ebb and flow, here's another way of getting 24-hour power.
What about a run-of-river scenario where you're a little more inland, you're not down where you have these massive flows of water? Maybe you've got a little ditch, for example, that runs quite predictably and continuously. Do you have any application there, or are you mainly sticking to some of the larger bodies, of larger rivers or tidal systems?
Yes, we do have an application for something like that that's not quite there yet. In the meantime, in our design and development process, we're going after what we call the low-hanging fruit, those readily identifiable sites that are deep and fast waters. So here, let me share with you what we've learned. And as a company, our company, we've examined over 40 different technologies around the world to get a real good feeling about their operational limits and capabilities. Most technologies right now are in conceptual stages. There's very few with working prototypes. But all those turbines that we call sort of in the free flow category require a minimum water velocity speed of about 2 meters per second. And probably water depths, which is about 6 feet per second, about 4 knot currents. And then water depths probably of about 30 feet. That gets to that earlier notion that I shared with you about the size of the rotor and the speed of the water. And that's probably the right combination to be cost effective. Of course, any deeper water and faster water is just better economics and more power. Mm-hmm. Now, most waterways, to your point, most rivers are shallower than that and they're slower than that. And so what we've been working on is a system that we call an accelerated flow system. It's a way of speeding up the water around the turbine. Now, Blue Energy up in Canada and Clean Currents have designed a system that's ducted, so it helps to funnel the water around the axial flow turbine to speed it up. So that's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is to create a Venturi effect, which sort of funnels the water through the turbine and speeds it up. And that could work not only in shallower and slower rivers, but also it might work in man-made canals and aqueducts. And so, for example, think about your California situation. There's 11,000 miles of canals throughout California. It's like one huge, giant storage battery. And so there could be systems that someday could be working in those canals as well.
Mm-hmm. So it'd just be a matter of taking a section of river that is accessible and plausible. You install your Venturi or whatever ductwork and with your generator, and you have a node of a system there.
That's right. And, of course, then the other factor that you have to work into all of this when you examine a place is where you are putting these systems and how close is one to a load pocket, or, again, that's sort of utility speak, but how close are you to where the power is needed or to transmission or distribution lines or to industrial parks or even to a city, a building. So yeah, everything you design is to be close to the pocket. So that's one factor. And then the other factor is weighing not only fish passage or endangered species that may be in the area, but also navigational issues. And what you want to do is interfere with any kind of water, shipping or traffic. Obviously, needless to say, when it comes to water, there's a lot of competing competing interests for water.
Mm-hmm. I have to divert here for a second and tell you a joke.
Okay.
This is a true story. I have lived in the past in a town called Fountain Green, Utah. It's a little podunk town. And I'm actually here right now visiting my parents with my kids. And, water is a premium for these farmers, especially, a few years back when everything was agriculture. And they were installing a power plant on their irrigation water system. And the farmers were just up in arms. They had a community meeting. I mean, they're dealing with the water. You know, what are you doing with our water?
Uh-huh.
And so they had a special community meeting, and it was made very clear that the same amount of water that went into this turbine system came out. In other words, they're not losing any water. Finally, this exasperated farmer raised his hand and says, "Well, who's going to want that water after all the electricity's taken out of it?"
Oh, I love it. That is very rich. It's also very poignant in the sense that he is very typical. He's not atypical. Most people have no idea where their electricity comes from, how it's produced, or its economic impact when it comes to work. So it's very telling in many ways, that comment, and which is very funny.
Well, speaking of other usages of the water, one thing that we've not addressed yet, I asked a little earlier, we didn't get around to an answer. What about the fish impact and other living things in the water? How's this going to impact that? With wind turbines, we have bird kill, which is an issue.
Right. Yeah. In this case, with the turbines, I mentioned how slow they rotate. And let me use East River as an example of what might be expected elsewhere. The turbines that are about 16 feet in diameter and during the mean low tide are about 6 to 8 feet below the surface. They're separated from side to side of about 40 feet, and each row is separated by, and they're offset about 100 feet. And we have six in the water right now operating and generating and delivering power. The turbines I mentioned turn very slowly, and we've invested over $2 million to set up what's called hydroacoustic transducers. Now, we have 24 of those in the water, which are like ultrasonic systems that are on each side of the turbine rows, and they're far field, fore and aft of the entire field. So we can literally, on screen, watch schools of fish approach the turbine fields, and then if they don't swim around, over, or under these turbines, we can actually watch them go through the turbines. But if you imagine these things, how they're turning slowly, what we're seeing is fish are swimming around, and those larger fish that are going right through are not being affected at all. And so we're gathering this empirical evidence to that very point. And we'll continue to do so for probably the next 18 months. And we're monitoring 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But as one might imagine, when fish sense something in their way, they swim around it or avoid it. The beauty of water is it's about 800 times denser than air. So when you have, and these aren't sharp propellers that are being motor driven through the water. These are turbines that are turning at the speed of the current. And they have blunt edged, if you will, these rotors. And so when fish are coming through, they can even sense, they can feel the pressure of this rotor coming toward them, and they just move away very slowly because they're not moving that fast. And so that's very encouraging. And of course, there's no sediment, there's no disturbance in the water. These things are all kind of natural. They're passive yaws when they turn. And there's no emissions whatsoever, so that's really good in the sense of global warming. So far, so good. We haven't seen any impacts. If for some unforeseeable reason that no one imagined, because we work with a lot of fish biologists and the natural resources agencies in all these cases, the beauty of these systems, because they're modular, is that they can come out of the water faster than they went into the water. And that's what's kind of nice about modern systems can be moved around or the rays reconfigured. If we're seeing that there is some environmental impact that no one even anticipated. But I think the monitoring and the watching is what we'll continue to do, just to make sure there is no impact on the environment.
What about the, obviously if the fish are not being impacted, and you spent $2 million, I was expecting you to maybe say something like we spent, $20,000 or something like that, $2 million
right.
In big wad of cash for studying this very issue.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you anticipate that there's going to be a lot of hackles being raised is, what are you doing in this water system? On the one hand, one segment of the environmentalist lobby is going to say, well, we would love to have clean power. On the other hand, they're going to say, well, what are you doing to the fish? And
right.
So you obviously have anticipated that, and you've dumped a lot of money into that. That's commendable, and I think that's good that you're doing that. You're anticipating that. And you're saying what you're seeing so far is that no, this is not impacting the fish. What about other systems, plant life? What about the flow of the sandbars and other river types of? There's a lot of systems in a river system. What are some of the other things you're seeing in terms of the effect of the installation of one of these?
Right. Good question. What we're seeing in the waters that, remember I mentioned the speed of the water that's really necessary for what's cost-effective. East River, again, for example, because the water is moving so fast, there is no sediment. We're on top of bedrock. And it's the same with the St. Lawrence River, where we're putting our systems up there in Canada. Again, the water is so fast in these river reaches where we're going, there is no sediment. It's just bedrock. And so there's no plant life there. And also, we're designing in the East River. We design systems that are on monopiles that are drilled into that bedrock. Our future systems will be designed in such a way that they can almost, if you can imagine, a lunar landing-like device, gravity-fed or ballasts that are flooded. Then it'll just lower into the water on toes of sorts to cling on for a wide base, and it can be lifted up really easily. So that's our approach to all this, just minimal disturbance of something that right now there's no plant life or to speak of. It's just mostly the fish that we're concerned about and navigation. Those seem to be the two primary issues. We are conducting over 11 different studies and assessments based on the National Environmental Protection Act scoping studies that was called NEPA. And so in compliance with NEPA, we're examining all of this. And the reason we're taking so much on our shoulders is because this has never been done before. It obviously raises a lot of questions. And so we'll be able to get to some of those answers and address those issues. And that's why we're willing to put the kind of money into this first project to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, yeah, that is a lot. Let's talk about navigation in terms of your inner river. And when we think of rivers, we think also of boats, both recreation as well as you know, commercial vessels that are going to be going through there. What kind of beacons or what kind of above water signals do you have to warn the craft that there's something underneath the water that they might need to be aware of?
Right. In our approach to this business, we've taken a very collaborative approach with the community, meeting with the community and the resource agencies up front, early on, and to be very transparent. In other words, sharing how we're approaching this, problems we've run into and how we resolve those problems, and actually getting the community involved in helping us design. And the community, actually there's communities within communities, so there are certainly those communities that are concerned about fishing or fish passage, and there's also the navigational community. And in New York, it's called the Harbor Operations Navigational and Security Community. Committee. So working with them, which is the Coast Guard, the Army Corps of Engineers, the dredgers, the Pilots Association, all the tugboat haulers, what we know about New York is that the heavy traffic, the deep draft vessels, all go to the West Channel in the East River, and we're in the East Channel of the East River. For the most part, there are just recreational craft. Around our turbine field, which the ultimate field, the one I said it could be much larger, producing up to 10 megawatts of installed capacity, and maybe as many as 300 turbines. That field, like the field of six that are currently in the water, have permanent navigational aids that mark the boundary of the turbine field, and there is a boom that goes around the field. But even if a motorboatist was in trouble or he jumped the boom and landed in the water, even then, there's 6 to 8 foot clearance between the slow-moving rotor and the hull, the keel of his boat. And so those are the kinds of things that we take into account. In the St. Lawrence River, for example, we're not in the St. Lawrence Seaway, but we are in the St. Lawrence River and some of the tributaries that feed into the Seaway, and that's where we put systems in the St. Lawrence. So everything that's how we approach it. We won't go where there's deep draft vessels that are navigating, or theoretically, if the water's deep enough, we could be below deep draft vessels. So, for example, in San Francisco, there is a firm that has, in fact, there's several different entities that are putting permits down to try to do tidal power in San Francisco. Obviously there, those systems are going to have to be deep enough that deep draft vessels and submarines can go over the top of them. And the only then thing would be to have on NOAA charts, you just put symbols on NOAA charts, just don't drop your anchors here, because your anchor, but see, the beauty of having a turbine, a field of turbines, even if a ship was in trouble and had to drop their anchor, it may take out four or five turbines, but the whole field would not be going down. The field would be designed in such a way that if you lost X number of turbines, the field would still be generating electricity.
And the mooring for your anchors actually might help them stop faster.
That's right. Something for the hook to grab onto.
Thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's
right.
So, well, you've done a lot of work and are still doing a lot of work. I asked a little earlier, when are we going to start seeing these things start, you know, going up in larger quantities where you're actually in some production of scale?
Well, here's our plan. we're now, as I mentioned to you, we are optimizing the system based on the success that we're seeing with the 6 turbines currently operating in the water. And so we're optimizing it and scaling for manufacturing. Our plan is to submit to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission our application for license probably toward the tail end of this year, knowing that that the license process itself has a bit of a lead time. And so while we're continuing to study the operations of these 6 for environmental impacts and operational tests, we'll file for a license. And then by the time the license is issued, our 18 months of studies would probably come to an end, and we'd see during that time that no harm. So we're looking at hopefully being issued a license by the latter part of 2008. And in the meantime, the systems that we're now optimizing will go into production in anticipation of beginning to slowly start putting them into the water and build out in this sort of monitored stage. So we're seeing probably commercial systems going into New York by 2008. We would see the next generation of river systems probably going into the St. Lawrence River at about the same time, with the new deployment systems that are designed for river applications, because there these systems wouldn't have the slack tide to take advantage of putting systems in and out of the water. So it would be a new type of system. So we see all.
That's when you'll go down to about $2.50 per watt.
Yeah, well, that gets right. Yeah, that's what both systems we see at that $2,400 mark. For as in $24 per kilowatt installed. So if we had a, let's say, I'll just use this rough, if we had a 10 kilowatt generator, then that would be a $24,000 system. And then if it was a 100 kilowatt generator, that'd be a $240,000 system, times how many systems you put in. So that's how you can do a quick math on what a project might cost.
When there's a hurricane that comes in the bay where or into the river system, you know, and I realize up in New York that's going to be a 1 in 100 year type of scenario, is that going to mess up your system, or are you going to be somewhat impervious because you're under the water there?
That's exactly right. Because we're under the water, it wouldn't affect the system at all. It's that surge, it's the rise of the water that causes so much damage. And so, no, it wouldn't hurt the system. But it does kind of go to show, if you think about the damage, the horrible damage that hurricanes cause, it's never really the wind, it's the power of the water. And it allows me to digress a minute with you about the wind turbines. For wind people, for example, will say they like it when the air is really humid because there's more energy in humid air. And I'll kid our wind brethren about how humid the conditions are where we're working. So it really kind of goes to show you the power of water. Now, and so here's what gets really interesting about applications to the kind of finishing up on another question you'd asked, where do you go from here? If you think about moving water everywhere and ocean currents and rivers, the World Energy Council and the United Nations did a survey of how much undeveloped potential hydropower there is in the world. And I was just looking at the conditions for commercially viable hydropower. And they said that there's probably close to 25 million megawatts of potential. And that's a staggering number to think about. And that's something that's always in the back of our minds about how might we go after much of that power without having to build dams, which displace people, and in the cases of China, end up flooding agricultural lands and burying antiquities. So we think
and
the applications
all plausible,
of these...
That's all, yeah. Plausible locations, right?
That's exactly right. And so here's the other thought that I wanted to share with you about the challenges I see ahead for this. Because what we're really talking about is not only our company, Verdant Power, it's a whole burgeoning new industry. And the industry has tremendous, I think, ramifications. And here's what I'm getting at. 15% of the world's population live in developed countries. And we, 15%, are using well over 60% of the world's fossil fuels. Hence the kind of pollution we're seeing and just the diminishing of those resources. I mean, I'm all for using oil. It just, I don't think we should be burning it. There's lots of uses for oil. But once it's burned, it's gone and a terrible expense. So, but then here's the other thought. 35% of the world's population, in other words, twice the number that live in developed countries, nearly 2 billion people, don't even have access to electricity. And yet you can imagine most of them are living near some kind of moving water, just out of necessity for water. I mean, there's a lot who don't, but many do. And so then the other thought that occurs to us is that in this day and age of globalization that's here, the best way to spread wealth, and wealth has lots of various meanings, is through infrastructure and education. And so the more that we could innovate in America to create systems that could be exported out of America to help developing countries and those 35, you know, those 2 billion people to produce their own power for electricity that might do things like power sewing machines, for women to create goods and services for trade. It creates economic stability for communities. I mean, what a gift if America be in that situation. To be in that situation, though, there's going to require political will here in America, which means creating economic incentives. And by that, I mean production tax credits and investment tax credits. And if you find states, and in fact, that's what the state of California did to get the wind industry off the ground. So if you start seeing more and more of that going on, more and more companies will get into this business, will become innovating, the costs will come down. It'll be good for America, both in terms of energy and environmental benefits, but also could be good for America in the terms of economic benefits, in other words, job creation. And it's a lot to share with you, but I want to get that kind of into the mix of our conversation because I think it's a rich subject.
That. In talking about these considerations and the scope of the field, a couple of questions really quick. On the 25 million megawatts of potential worldwide for tidal river systems along the lines of what you're talking about, where your system could be applied. How much does that compare to the present worldwide usage? How many megawatts are we using globally right now? It seems like we're not that high yet, are we?
No. In fact, I'm just trying to do some mental machinations. I could, just before you ask that question, I'm starting to think about what does that compare to. Right now, I think in the United States, there's about, I think 70,000 megawatts currently is being produced by hydropower in the United States, which is about 9 to 10% of the amount of power the United States uses. So in that figure, let's say the United States is about 700,000 megawatts U.S.
Okay.
And of course, we're such energy gluttons in this country, but that gives you some idea, 700,000 megawatts. So if there's 25 million megawatt potential globally, it gets pretty interesting. One of those potentials, by the way, is the Gulf Stream. And here's this marvelous ocean current that flows along, and where it comes closest to the United States off the coast of Florida, independent analysis said there's probably as much as 700,000 megawatts. In other words, the entire amount of electricity that's being generated in the United States right now could be generated near Florida in the Gulf Stream, which is kind of a staggering thought when you put in that kind of context.
Yeah, of course, then you've got the transmission of that, but it is an interesting
thought
about that we don't need to be relying on fossil fuels. And, you know, talking about the economics of this system and bringing down price, obviously as the price comes down, there are going to be other companies that are going to jump into the industry. You're not going to be you're not alone now, and you're certainly not going to be alone in the future. You're dumping a lot of money into the development and pioneering this, answering questions that are going to be of benefit to the others that come along in the future. What's going to enable you to get a return on this investment that you're dumping in? Obviously, you've got investors putting money into your company. What assures them that they're going to get a return on that investment of this pioneering money that they're dumping in?
Well, a couple of things. We've been at this for about 8 years, and we've been very close to all the regulatory agencies and resource agencies. And so what they've asked us to do to gather this evidence is really based on our technology design. Where we draw comfort is that our competitors, once they have a system that they show it's working in kind of a reliable fashion, they're going to have to go through the same thing. They're going to be required to put their systems to a 2 to 3 year test, just like we've been doing, to gather evidence that their particular technology is not hurting the environment or the fish. which gets real interesting, because in that time, we'll have a lead time by that time, and we're taking our systems to commercialization. So in other words, we'd have a 2 to 3 year jump into the marketplace to begin signing up contracts, forming deals with municipalities, agencies, industrial parks, resorts, and remote areas. And so we'll have it. So that's how we rationalize certainly the benefit to the payoff of investing now.
What kind of a patent or IP do you have on this?
We have about 16 current patents and about 24 more that we're about to file in all kinds of places. As you can imagine, almost daily we're making new discoveries, because you have not only the designs of the rotor for mechanical power, but then how do you cost-effectively move that mechanical power to electricity? Gearing ratios, direct drive generators, speed increasers, how they're housed, couplings, electronic systems. All of that, we're making discoveries, and every discovery we make, we're filing a patent on it. And we're filing blocking patents in some areas, for example, in the slower waterways. The way we accelerate the flow of the water, we're filing patents on those systems. So we think of ourselves as a company, Verdant Power anyway, that we're not wed to any one technology as much as we think of ourselves as innovators and system integrators, using a lot of off-the-shelf component parts, but using them in new ways, which we then also patent, see? So that's how we correct our IP. But it gives us also the kind of flexibility, Sterling, that and experience that now we as a company, knowing all the different technologies and how they work, we can look at any body of moving water to determine what's the most cost-effective way to get the most energy out with the least amount of environmental impact. And that's what we want to become as a company, is that kind of solution solver, I guess, or problem solver.
When I open up my version of Adobe Acrobat, the PDF reader, I see a list of about 50 patents that they list right there as it's being opened, and it's like, you know, kind of like beware. I can imagine that down, you know, 20 years from now, when we see a list of patents that Verdant Power has, there's probably going to be comparable in the numbers of things that you will have come up with in that integrated system by then. It reminds me of that a little bit.
It's interesting. We're also looking at ourselves as sort of being a different kind of electric generator, and I like to draw. Yeah, there's a wonderful book out, Wickonomics, if you've not heard about it, and it really talks about how mass collaboration is going to change every society in the world, and it sort of springboards off another book that I really like that's called The Wisdom of Crowds, and it's really about how people collectively are more intelligent than experts, and so sort of a humbling reminder that the best way for us to do what we as a company want to do, in other words, our mission is to really help build sustainable communities around the world, is to get everybody involved, not worry too much about patents or holding patents, but get involved to the extent that we can be, you know, making our money by licensing, by royalties. In other words, almost like open sourcing, sending it out for everybody to work with and improve upon, and creating that kind of relationship with the global community.
Now, how does that work on a practical level? Are you talking about an open source type of, you know, where you have a website that says, here are our designs, if you have any ideas, post them here, it's part of a collective pool, this is forever free domain as part of an open source definition. How are you going to do that?
I think the way I look at it, the way we're looking at it right now, of course, every day is a new day of discovery, is to create a kind of a supply chain management around the world. So all around the world, Verdant Power in countries would be manufacturing certain component parts, and so everybody would be sort of manufacturing in a country, buying from countries, selling to country, and that kind of network, sort of networks coupled up with networks around the world, is how I see it happening. So, for example, Verdant Power India may come up with a solution for deployment using hemp that meets the problem and the needs that Verdant Power China has been wrestling with for several months. But we'd use the internet in such a way that this information can be moved around with each other. So I see that to some extent, how it could work.
Mm-hmm. We've not talked about international yet. We've talked mainly U.S., Canada. Mm-hmm. What are your plans, and what's in the offing for other, obviously you can't bite off too much at once, but
right.
What are your plans internationally?
Well, we're focusing on countries that culturally are similar to ours. So it's Canada, the UK, and the United States. And so that's where we are right now. We're looking at getting over to the UK. The UK has put some great money into developing some of the big tidal and wave systems. But their tidal systems are more deep water offshore. And our range of systems could be in between, working with them for some of the shallower waters, more closer to end users. And so UK would be next, working in Canada, not only in rivers, but the tidal waters of Canada as well, and certainly the United States and its river systems. And we also have teams of people working on our behalf, really kind of doing a bit of relationship marketing and resource assessments in India, Brazil, and China, in anticipation of someday getting into those countries as well. Of course, these applications could be everywhere, but the methodologies for getting into countries, really identifying the right kind of partners, strategic partners in country, and joint development partners in country is how we're approaching it.
Now, you talk about teams of people, and you've got, you know, obviously quite a few people involved here. How big is Verdant Power at this point?
Well, we're still small. Right now we have a little over 20 people full-time, and we have about 10 consulting engineers. And then we have a whole roster of great resumes, people we'd love to bring on board as soon as we get better funded. And that will come. I mean, in time, more investors will come in, and it's only probably a matter of time that we'll probably go public. We'll do it the old-fashioned way, go public when we're starting to look at revenues, perhaps, and contracts signed up. So all that's in the works. And so it'll be a nice kind of growth and a managed kind of growth. Looking to bring eventually more project managers on board and project engineers on board, and from the communities. So it'll be kind of a community-based, community-centric employment.
So let's say somebody wants to invest in your company. What kind of investment are you looking at, and how do they proceed?
Yeah, right now we're privately held. And we look at probably going public. I'm just guessing offhand, maybe 18 months, no more than 2 years now, but certainly by 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would do that. And that might be the best opportunity.
So when you say if we had a little more money, you know, how does that money come in, and how do you court that money?
Well, right now we have the money that we're getting right now is from a large hedge fund, Tudor Investments in Boston, and they have put one tranche, half that money in one tranche, and we're being hopeful that the second tranche will come in soon. And that money, what that does is take us to commercialization. And right now we're being very, very focused on the three types of technologies that I mentioned, the tidal power, certainly in the East River of New York, the river power in Canada, and also this accelerated flow system that can work in shallower and slower waters that has applications to most rivers and to canals and aqueducts. So we're focused on those three technologies, and once those are operating in a reliable fashion, and then we are lining up customers for those technologies in their waterways.
Mm-hmm.
So the money right now that we're having keeps us very focused on those three development paths.
Now, when we were speaking before we came on the air, I think a couple of weeks ago when we scheduled to have you come on the show, you mentioned something to the effect about Verdant Power being, I can't remember the wording, but the idea was that you were, and you weren't saying it in a boasting way, but that you were ahead of the pack of all the different river tidal companies out there. Maybe you can give us an idea of where you rank in comparison to, and of course, you know, there's this "my baby's the most beautiful baby" syndrome that everyone thinks their thing is the best. But
right.
How would you rank yours in comparison to other tidal river systems out there?
Well, it's a good question. Thanks. As I mentioned, we've examined over 40 different technologies. In fact, for the Electric Power Research Institute, we wrote for several years in a row, we wrote the definitive chapter on these technologies. So here's how I see us ranking. And most of these technologies are still very conceptual. A lot of great concepts out there, but no working prototypes. Now, we have, in the course of our time, we've been around, well, actually we incorporated in 2000, we have built 4 different working prototypes, and we've tested them in conjunction with Ontario Power Generation, the state of Massachusetts, and with the help of the state of New York and their engineers. In fact, the state of New York is our, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority is our business partner in New York. Now, what we've concluded in all these different technologies and tests that we've actually built prototype, field experience, is it's sort of like a lesson from the wind. The wind industry never took off until all the technologies began to converge on 3-bladed axial flow upstream rotors. And after all of our conclusions, what we have in the water operating in New York is a 3-bladed axial flow downstream rotor. In other words, the rotor is away from the direction of the current, and the nose cone of our rotor, or of our nacelle, is used to sort of guide the turbine into the current, and in the case of a tide, it swings around. And so here we are. Others are just getting their working prototypes built and have done some quasi-tests, but here we are. We've been in the water for several months now, continually generating power, delivering power on average now of about a megawatt, in other words, 1,000 kilowatt hours a day are being generated and delivered to customers. And so that's why I say we're ahead of the pack, because we've done some historic firsts here in not only getting in the water, a field of turbines, but actually generating and producing power on a reliable basis to customers in New York City.
Well, we are to the end of our time here. We want to make sure that we get your website out to people so they can look you up online. What is that?
It's the 3 W's dot Verdant Power as one word .com.
That's Verdant Power.com.
Yes.
And we appreciate you coming on the show. I remember seeing you on at least a couple of televised specials. Were you on CNN? Did I remember right?
Yeah, well, yes, we've been on television quite a bit. The Sundance Channel, a couple of months ago, we were on its program on cities. And I'm glad you brought that up, because tomorrow night, Sunday, at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Discovery Channel, we'll be on that as well. So Discovery's done a documentary on us, and it'll air on Sunday night, 9 p.m. And so has National Geographic has done a documentary that'll air probably this coming spring.
Very good. Well, it's been a delight. I appreciate, again, you being willing to come on the show, and we wish you the best. And you are, I believe, on our Top 100 Energy Technologies listing at top100energy.com. And we'll be creating a feature page about you on our site. We don't have one yet, but we'll get one up there. And we wish you the best in helping to push forward clean and affordable green energy technology.
Oh, thank you very much, Sterling. It's been a joy to be on your show, and we really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Take care.
Thank you, Sterling. Bye now.
Bye.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.